Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we bring you exciting new guests, of course, to talk about UFOs and the paranormal. And I want to apologize for the slight delay we had. Sometimes these things happen, it can't be helped, but we are starting now and ready to go. I hope you enjoyed our show last week. Our guest was Maureen Halloran. She's a psychic intuitive who works a lot with tarot cards and things like this. She's a very interesting lady. She had a lot of interesting stories to tell. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the show, remember, all the shows are archived on the BBS website. But tonight, I am so excited to have a guest back on the show, actually. She was one of the first guests on this show, and which has been running now for over 2 years. And I'm so excited to finally have her back. Her name is Linda Godfrey. And wow, is she making a mark on the paranormal field. She's written like 10 books so far, including one novel. Her paranormal books include some really popular series like Weird Michigan and Weird Wisconsin, part of the Weird Books series, which is really quite popular. She's also written a book, a classic in the field, The Beast of Bray Road. That's Hunting Wisconsin's Werewolf. And that was followed by Hunting the American Werewolf. And so she's really quite accomplished in this field and has written other books since then, including two so far in a children's series, which is called Mysteries, Legends, and Unexplained Phenomena. She's written a book about a lake monsters and sea monsters, as well as one about werewolves, of course, and another one upcoming, I understand. So we're very, very honored to have her on the show. Linda Godfrey, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Wow, it's my pleasure, Preston. Thank you so much. Has it been 2 years? It seems hard to believe.
I know, time goes fast. Boy, you
have
been busy.
Been having
fun. Yeah, you've been busy, all these books. Wow. That's very,
yeah,
really exciting.
I've been averaging 2 a year, and actually it's 10 books plus the novel. So, and I'm working on 2 more nonfiction books right now, so.
Wow.
Keeps me off the streets.
So which one was the first? Was it the novel or the Beast of Bray Road?
Actually, my very first book was a true crime. It's called The Poison Widow, A True Story of Sin, Strychnine, and Murder. And it's about a Wisconsin woman. A story was nationally known at the time, but now is almost entirely forgotten until I discovered it and wrote about it. She actually had a college-age lover. She was a prim, church-going lady, very esteemed in the community. Her husband was on the church council. They had 4 beautiful children, and yet she and her college-age lover murdered her husband with strychnine, would have gotten away with it, except then they also decided to do away with the 4 children, and then things just went kind of crazy from that point on.
Wow. Well, there's that recent story in the news going on with that other Craigslist
murder. The Craigslist
killer. You just never know, huh? Sometimes,
yeah,
like,
you
yeah.
just wonder, well, you know, the thing was, everybody who knew her, nobody had the slightest inclination or thought that she could have done this. And my question at the time was, how well do you ever really know anybody?
Wow. That's pretty scary.
Yeah. But, yeah, I actually think that the human beasts are much more frightening than any of the other creatures that I write about.
You know, I've had UFO witnesses tell me that they're more afraid of the government, the human government, than the aliens themselves. That's funny. So then it was followed up by The Beast of Bray Road. Was that your first foray,
yeah, my
I
second
should say?
Book, exactly. The Beast of Bray Road, Tailing Wisconsin's Werewolf, is the lead-in book to my series and tells how I got the newspaper story and what happened in the town and the first sightings, and then the ones that followed after that, and even goes into, it has a lot of the cultural effects of it, such as the attempted early movie deals, which, by the way, there is a movie also called The Beast of Bray Road that I had nothing to do with.
That's right. That's right. I have seen it actually on the, I've seen on TV.
Sci-Fi Channel plays it continually, but it really has nothing to do with any of the actual sightings. It's really a very Hollywood type slasher movie, but they used my title and kind of the basic premise and pretended it was set in Elkhorn, although the sheriff's license plate has California on it, so, you know, little details like that. But, you know, it's fun and in its place, but it doesn't have anything to do with the actual sightings or my research.
Right, right. You know, your research is so unique, and I remember being really stunned by it because I thought I was pretty educated in the paranormal field, but to hear about werewolves, I mean, that's something else. And this is something that, I mean, you take totally seriously, right? I mean, these things are actually walking around.
Well, you know, I really do believe the witnesses, and now 17 years later, there are hundreds and hundreds of them. I get from 1 to 5 reports a day, excuse me, a week. Sometimes one a day or more than one in a day. It's always surprising. I think I had 5 this past week from all over
really?
The world. You know,
recent
so there's
one?
Something going on. But I and my publisher loves to call it werewolf because that's the sexy word. That's the word everybody relates to. And sometimes I'll even revert to it when I want to give someone a quick mind picture because what the witnesses all say is if there was such a thing as werewolves, this is what it would look like, except it has no human parts. You know, this creature that is seen by everyone, unless it falls into a separate category that I classify as phantom dogs or hellhounds, or you have them the Native American skinwalker type group. Sometimes then, where things are clearly paranormal, you'll see a few other features occasionally. But the straight up sightings, and I'd estimate that it's probably more than 95% of the ones that I get, really don't show any characteristics that wouldn't be seen on some kind of natural animal. It's the behavior, the walking upright, the carrying things in its arms and with its elongated paws, and its aggressive nature and manner of intimidating people that frightens people and makes them think that they've seen something that isn't right.
Right. Well, it's really fascinating because I finally did get to interview my first werewolf witness not too long ago, actually. Her name is Sue.
That's right.
Yeah, I was shocked, of course.
Where was that?
This was in California. Her
wow.
name is Sue. I had her on the show, Sue Hutzel, and she spoke about it briefly, but just briefly, she saw this, it was daytime, and she was driving with friends, and they didn't see it. But the car was stopped long enough for her to see this wolf-like. She said it looked just like a wolf, like just like
mm-hmm.
you were saying, actually.
Yeah.
No, didn't look human at all, except for it was walking upright. And she
wow.
looked at it, and it was not far away, maybe 100 feet away. And it looked right at her, and she says it actually caught her eye, and they looked at each other's eyes for a second, and it went and it walked behind a log where it disappeared from view.
That has so many elements. That's a really typical sighting. A little more unusual daytime, but I do get those. I would like her to contact me if there's any way you can manage that.
Oh, she absolutely. I will email you her information. She would absolutely love to talk to you about it. She's had a
lot
of
unusual.
Yeah,
if you could do
experience.
That. Because for some reason, I don't know why exactly, but sightings are more numerous in the eastern half of the United States, east of the Mississippi and down through Texas. West of that area, I get them, but they're much more few and far between.
Huh. Wow.
So any that I can get from California, I'm really, really interested in.
Yeah, she actually lives more towards your area than mine, I think. I forget, but in the Midwest somewhere.
Oh, but, so the sighting was in the Midwest.
No, that's where she lives, just by
Oh, she lives, but she saw it again. Sorry, I'm all
right.
mixed up here.
She was
but,
on vacation when she saw the werewolf in California.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. I would still love to talk to her, so, yeah, if you can please email me that or have her get in touch with me, that's great.
So are these reports are you getting recent reports, you know, like from this year even?
Some are. Probably the bulk of them are often 2 to 30 years old because there are so many people sitting out there who have been keeping a lid on this experience all these years they maybe tentatively told someone when it first happened and were hooted out of the room, and so they've kept quiet. And then for some reason, they'll find out about my work, or somebody will stumble across my website, and they realize that they have a place that they can go and report it. Because, you know, even a lot of the sites that take Bigfoot reports, if you try and phone them and tell them that you saw something that looked like an upright wolf, they'll just say, well, no, you didn't. You saw a Bigfoot. And the witnesses that I talk to, and I do get Bigfoot reports too, and anyone who gets a good look at whatever they're seeing is very adamant as to which one it is. Either it's clearly what I call a man-wolf, that's my preferred term, or clearly a Bigfoot. They're really, really different. So to find a place that actually accepts that they saw what they saw and doesn't try and talk them into thinking that they are mistaken and that they actually saw something else comes as relief to people. And most of them just say, you know, I'm just really wanting to tell it to someone who doesn't tell me I'm crazy. And I'll tell you, if they are, they have lots and lots of company because so many hundreds of people have seen it all over the world and over many decades.
Right. Now, there are cases of Bigfoot where the Bigfoot can get pretty aggressive with humans. Is that true as well with these man-wolves? Is anyone
injured? It is, but in slightly different ways. It's kind of interesting because they are often spotted in roughly the same territory. So you almost are wondering if they run into each other. The man wolf does not seem to throw rocks at people as Bigfoot is reported to do, which makes a lot of sense because a canine's arms are not made for throwing objects. You know, they just don't have, there are technical terms for the anatomy I won't get into, but the way their arms attached to their shoulders. Primates have collarbones, and quadrupeds are things that are really designed to walk on four legs, do not. And it makes it really hard to do something like pitch a rock, you know. So they don't have that aggressive behavior, but they do tend to sort of bluff charge or stare aggressively, such as this woman described. It's like they look into the person's eyes, and sometimes the people will even feel it's giving them some kind of subliminal message, not in English so much, but they kind of get the idea, and it ranges from something like, I'd eat you if I could, or I'm really angry that you saw me, or if you tell anybody, I'll come and get you. And I've had people, and usually that's the last thing people will tell me. They'll say, well, you're going to think that I'm crazy, but you know, as long as I told you everything else, this is what I think. And so I don't know if there's some sort of telepathic development that's come along with this or if they're just able to emote this message that people get using body language signals that we're only subliminally aware of, you know, and just sort of translate in our own minds. But that's what I hear from a lot of people. Nobody in all these hundreds of reports, with one exception, has actually been physically hurt. And I'm talking about people who've been chased up close.
Wow.
And been up close. The only one I have was a man up in Quebec Province, Canada, and it lunged at him and caught its fang on the man's hip and left a very long, jagged scar. I've got a picture of that up somewhere on my website, beastofbrayroad.com. You'll have to kind of dig through some of the reports to find it. But I believe that even in that case, he was intending to scare rather than actually hurt, because if you've got a creature that large coming right at you and there's no place to go, you know, I think if he'd wanted to, he probably would have ripped the man's intestines out.
Right. Well, now that's interesting. I know I have to ask this. And I hope it's a little facetious, but he was all right after this man wolf bit him, right? I mean, he didn't turn, you know, there's the myth if you're bit by a werewolf.
Uh-huh.
You turn into one. But
oh.
That was all right.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me. To my knowledge, this man is fine. You know, and a lot of the lore that exists about werewolves comes from the early Hollywood movies of the 30s. And to be honest and fair, some of the early producers did kind of look up European folklore and base some of their ideas on that. But much of it just comes really straight out of the movies. And for instance, people will very often ask me, have I noticed any correlation with full moons? And
all
the
right.
answer is no. It seems to happen just at any time. Well, one problem is that people seldom remember the exact precise date if it's a sighting that occurred years earlier.
Right.
They'll just know that it was maybe mid-March and there was snow on the ground or something. And they'll remember if there was, very occasionally they'll remember that there was a full moon, but lots of times it's in the daytime or the weather was bad. And so I don't really have enough data to correlate that. But just from what I'm able to tell, there doesn't seem to be any correlation whatsoever. Pardon?
What about population density and things like that? I mean, in terms of humans, are these things mostly in rural areas, or have they been seen in areas where you would not expect them to be seen?
Oh, they've been seen right in Milwaukee. Other big cities, too. I'd say predominantly rural and wooded areas, but they can show up anywhere. I had one sighting by three people who saw it on one of the cloverleaf areas of an exit ramp off I-94 in the south part of Milwaukee, just before you exit to go to a giant mall, and it's a very industrialized, busy area. And, you know, that sounded kind of crazy at first, but one of the first things I do when I get a sighting that I'm really interested in is I'll go to a topographical map. When I looked at the map, I saw that this clover leaf was right across the street from a golf course. The sighting was in December when the golf course could have been unused. The golf course backed up to another golf course, which backed up to a little drainage area of the river that runs through Milwaukee and then into a nature preserve. So
wow.
There was a green, there, it's kind of amazing, but in almost any city, you'll find a green corridor and park between our park systems, cemeteries. There's always some place for these things to go and hide. Not only that, people in cities are now getting used to seeing coyotes, which are much smaller than any of these wolf things. The man wolf is usually estimated at between 5 and 7 feet tall. A coyote standing up might get up to 3 feet tall. They're not very big animals, but people are used to seeing those, and so seeing something a little larger skulking around, they might just think was a large dog hybrid. And these things can go on four legs. And if you see one on four legs, you really wouldn't think, oh, there's a werewolf. You would just think, there's a really strange-looking, really big canine of some kind. And
wow.
The same if you found a dead one. You know, you wouldn't really have any way to know.
Isn't that interesting? Wow. Now, you know, there are some cases where Bigfoot has been, you know, said to have powers like telepathy, and you mentioned the werewolf. Do they have, like, any other paranormal attributes? Because I know Bigfoot, there are some reports of that along with Bigfoot. I'm wondering, are these man-wolves, you know, quasi-physical almost, or in some cases?
Well, you know, they could be. I mean, most of the sightings don't have them doing anything that a fairly normal animal couldn't do. For instance, canines can walk and run on their hind legs. It's not a physical impossibility. They just don't do it normally unless they're trained or have some reason, like Faith, the dog on YouTube, which was born without its front limbs. In the wild, an animal like that probably wouldn't be able to survive, but this little Faith dog was trained by her owners to run upright. So it looks like a really paranormal behavior, but it is not outside the realm of physical possibilities. However, and I share this thought with Nick Redfern and some other researchers, we're not convinced that these are not transdimensional creatures. And it actually is what I've been told by my Native American friends, which is that they believe both Bigfoot and the man-wolf, which any of the tribal members that I've talked to anywhere have all told me that this animal was known to their grandfathers, in other words, their ancestors, and is in the tales that they don't like to talk about outside their own tribe. It's very rare for them to. It's something that they're extremely respectful of. But they believe that both Bigfoot and this creature are, we would call it transdimensional, they would call it spirit creatures, which can go back and forth between the spirit world and our world. And when they are here, then they are fully corporeal. They have to eat in order to survive and have energy. They can leave tracks. They have physical weight. They can shed hairs or whatever. But they know where the portals or interdimensional doors or windows are, and they can go through those. And that's how they can appear to inhabit the same territory where you wouldn't expect to be able to find so many large carnivores living in such close proximity. And it's why they disappear and people don't catch them.
Right. Well, what is the best evidence you have other than, you know, that guy who was bit, which is, you know, pretty darn good, and you have multiple witness testimony. Is there any photographs or hair samples or track cases?
Well, you know, I did have some people come up with a pretty weird-looking chunk of fur that was found near what I do believe is a pretty bona fide sighting. And if anybody has seen the History Channel Monster Quest show, there was one titled American Werewolf that's based on my book, Hunting the American Werewolf. And the fur is very prominently featured in there. The original chunk of it was 6 inches wide by about 3 inches wide, and it was so tough and tightly knit together, and there was no blood. It didn't look like it had been ripped off any animal. It was so tightly bound together that we had to use one of those heavy shears that cuts a penny. It'll cut a penny in half in order to get a small sample for me to send in. And I was pretty shocked and surprised. They didn't even get it as far as a DNA analysis. They did a structural analysis and found it to be cat hair. I was pretty surprised because it was a huge chunk and a thick chunk. And the first DNR agent I showed it to told me that to him it looked canine. So we came out with cat hair. I guess that's what we have to accept. I do have photos of footprints and drawings of eyewitness drawings of footprints, and they seem to range between 5 and 8 inches long. The hind feet, this is the one difference that, and it really isn't much more than an adaptation, that these creatures seem to have evolved, is that their feet and toe pads are elongated, which makes a lot of sense, because if your dogs and wolves normally walk just on their toe pads, but if you want to have a good sense of balance and spend any time at all walking on your hind legs, the bigger those toe pads are, the bigger your feet are, the better off you're going to be. And the same if you're trying to use your forepaws for holding and carrying things. You know, if anybody has a dog, they know how ridiculously short those little clubby paws are. And yet, my little Lhasa Apso will actually hold bones up with kind of between both of it. He has to squeeze both his paws together and then hold it. But if you can, and I just can imagine, if only his paws were a little longer, he'd have such an easier time. And it's easy to see how perhaps there could be an isolated population that over many thousands of years, these beneficial adaptations became part of their species, and perhaps they are a slightly separate relic species.
Well, it's interesting, I mean, because we allegedly, you know, we're related to the primates, and
right.
Of course, so these possibly could be a sentient canine type thing, and, you know, there's the ET reports, which some people feel could be like insectoid, some of them.
Right.
So it seems like we have all these intelligent species that we're just beginning to accept. I mean, is the werewolf intelligent, do you think, the man-wolf?
Everybody who sees it feels that it is smarter than just like your average dog or wolf or wild animal that you would normally see. They feel that it has a particular interest in humans and has a curiosity, and that it's anticipating things that the humans do and reacting in ways that normal animals would not. And it sort of makes sense. You know, anthropologists have long thought that the reason humans developed their large brain was because we found some reasons for it to be advantageous to begin standing up and being bipedal. And that when you do that, it frees your arms and hands, and you have to make a lot of new brain connections in order to do these new things with your arms and hands that you never used them for before that. So it only stands to reason that if indeed they have adapted these postural behaviors, that it has also affected their intelligence. And also, if the Native American theory is correct and they are transdimensional or spirit animals, well, you would expect them to have an extra degree of intelligence to be able to navigate different dimensions, too.
Right, right. Well, it's fascinating. Fascinating. So you've been researching other areas as well, like lake monsters, is that right?
Right. I actually had started that when I began researching for the Weird Michigan and Weird Wisconsin books. And by the way, I did write sequels to those for my other publisher, Trails Books. We had to title them a little bit differently. They're titled Strange Wisconsin, More Badger State Weirdness, and Strange Michigan, More Wolverine Weirdness.
Wow.
But all four of those books contain lake and sea monsters in both of those states. And then I was asked to write one for Chelsea House for that young adult series, Mysteries, Legends, and Unexplained Phenomena that you mentioned earlier. And so I had to do a lot more research into the cultural history of lake and sea monsters worldwide, and got into things like the Loch Ness Monster and the large Great Lake monsters that there are, and how some of those things could be explained and how some of them can't. But yeah, I really have expanded to most unidentified creatures, because we've had the sighting of the man bat, you know, in La Crosse, Wisconsin. That's explored in the Strange Wisconsin book. And that started leading me into large human-sized things with wings. You know, Mothman of Point Pleasant is another example of that.
Wow. I'm kind of speechless. Batman or Man Bat?
Man
I had not heard that one.
Yeah, that one was 40 Times Magazine picked that one up. And I'm talking to at least one TV program about doing a show on it right now. This happened just 2 years ago, just outside of La Crosse, which is the Mississippi River town on the western edge of Wisconsin, that is probably best known for mysterious drowning deaths of college students. I think there are 7 now, something like that at least. They seem to just walk into the river and drown, and very unexplained. And it was just a few days before the most recent one of those drownings that a man in his 50s and his 25-year-old son were driving home about 9 p.m. They hadn't been drinking or anything like that. And this huge thing suddenly flew at the windshield of their truck. They thought it was going to hit it, but instead it, at the last second, veered up and kind of soared off into the trees. And they described it as something with a 10-foot wingspan, bat-like wings, and a body the size of, roughly humanoid and the size of a man, but covered in fur and with fangs. And as it flew upward, it emitted a piercing shriek, and both of the men became physically ill from it.
Oh, wow.
They had to pull over. The son threw up all night. The father was sick for 2 weeks. And I was able to be on the scene and investigate it within 2 weeks, and spent extensive time with the witnesses and traveled over the sighting area and looked around. And I'm still convinced, and I have witness sketches from him, And then after I had posted that on my Beast of Bray Road website, I received some corroborating reports from other witnesses. And I also had a report in that same area, right off the river, of a lizard man from a couple of people. So I go into that whole thing in the Strange Wisconsin book. It gets kind of detailed. There's a lot to the story. But there's something really strange over on that Mississippi River area, flying up and down. And it's odd how many large man-sized bird reports you do get, whether they have bat wings or some people describe them as more pterodactyl-like.
Huh.
And it's not just Wisconsin. You know, it's just about every state.
It's astonishing because you don't hear a lot about this really at all. So it makes you wonder just how much people are seeing that they're not saying.
That's a really good point, Preston, because I believe that just for the man-wolf alone, maybe I get, if I'm lucky, 10% of all the sightings that are really out there, because for everyone that finds me, there are many, many more that don't, many, many more who are still too afraid to speak up, and I think many who are actually in denial, who would have to admit that man doesn't know everything if they admitted that they saw, you know, a wolf running upright on its hind legs or chasing them or whatever it was that they saw.
Right. Well, you know, as far as lake monsters, do you have any evidence or any speculation even that they are sentient or intelligent, you know, like humans? Or are these just, you know, unidentified, you know, eels and giant snakes and, that, you know, what have you?
Yeah, well, you know, those reports do go very far back. And if you go back to, like, the ones that were seen in Chesapeake Bay, you know, in the early, oh, I think the 1700s, or late 1700s, early 1800s, they called it Chessie. There were, people had the feeling, I think, sometimes that it was observing boats and sort of toying with them as much as anything. They get the idea that it's curious, that sort of thing. I don't know if you would say intelligent. There was one right in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which is a very deep lake. It's not one of the most giant lakes, but it's pretty big and it's very, very deep. And there were people coming from Chicago on the train in the 1800s and early 1900s to look for this Jenny, the Lake Geneva Sea Monster, as it was called. And one of the staunchest witnesses was a minister. There were groups of people that swore they saw it. You know, and could it really have been there? Marine biologists will say there's really not a way for it to be supported. You know, there are a couple of different theories. One is that many of our lakes and waterways, particularly Loch Ness, are connected by underground caverns and fissures and waterways that we don't really even know about and can't detect. Mm-hmm. And that's how they occasionally just pop up in lakes, but they really are supported elsewhere, you know, more in the ocean depths. But then the other idea is very similar to the Native Americans' idea of Bigfoot and the man-wolf being trans-dimensional creatures. I know Nick Redfern is a real proponent of this, that perhaps they also are coming in through the what John Keel called window areas and show up to observe us for their own purposes and then go back to wherever it was they came from.
Well, it's interesting, you know, we've got like four lakes here in California that have lake monsters in them, so I guess they're pretty popular. I know Lake Champlain, I think that's what it's called, one of the last great lakes, I guess they call it Lake Champlain. They did
right.
Some research there where they put an underwater microphone and were able to capture some sort of sea creature doing echolocation. And supposedly there's none in there that are, you know, recognized.
Yeah, they call that one Champ. Yeah, they did that there, and they've done quite a few. Yeah, P.T. Barnum once offered $50,000 for the body of Champ. And
oh, wow.
I think it was in In 2006, it was ABC News that got a video of Champ that was shot by two fishermen on a digital camera, and they had it analyzed by a forensic image analyst who found no evidence that the images had been manipulated in any way. Champ was also supposed to have caused a steamship accident in 1873. A boat ran right into it and almost swamped it with all the people. Champ is probably one of the more often frequently sighted creatures of lake and sea.
Right. Well, there's got to be more than one of them, too, if they're surviving for this long. Right.
Yeah, exactly. They couldn't be that widely dispersed. You know, and then there are so many different versions of them, too. You know, they don't all look the same. So it's, and the people have asked me the same thing about the man wolf. Do I think there's more than one? Well, yes. For one thing, people have seen up to four at a time together.
Oh,
And again, they could not be spread over such time and geography unless there were more than one sort of a breeding population.
Well, isn't that interesting? Now, is there any UFO connection with any of these reports that you've, you know, noticed that's overt at all?
That's an interesting question, whether there's a UFO connection. I don't know if I can exactly call it a connection. It's true that many other researchers have noticed this. I'm certainly not the originator of the idea, but there seem to be here and there what people call areas of strangeness. Certain, I don't know if it's the configuration of the land, or sometimes it'll be a dense forested area. In Texas, there's one called the Big Thicket. There's this famous Skinwalker Ranch in Utah. I identified a place in southern Wisconsin I call the Jefferson Square of Weirdness. It's a square area 13 miles on each side, which is in itself strange. And then within these areas, you find, once you find Bigfoot, you often find other strange creatures. You find marsh lights. You find a higher percentage of hauntings, and usually also UFOs. Now, I've never had anybody say to me, yeah, I saw the man wolf coming out of the UFO, or the UFO came down and then I saw a man wolf. I do have a story that I think is very interesting in the Strange Wisconsin book. It was somewhere around the Eau Claire area, maybe 20 years ago, where a group of people had documented UFO activity, where they actually saw craft and saw lights coming down and making landing motions, that sort of thing, and then began seeing this really odd creature. Hmm. And they felt there was a connection, but there's no way to prove it. You know, they would see it making a motion as to land, and then this strange creature that looked kind of like a naked werewolf with a very triangular head would show up. And, you know, that's probably the report that I've gotten that comes closest, I think, to making a bona fide connection.
Right. So it's the exception rather than the rule.
You know, in terms of general areas, if you look, you're probably going to find some UFO reports. But making that connection, you know, is the really hard part. And, you know, it's closer to circumstantial evidence, I think, than really cause and effect. You know, you just can't say that since they're both there, the Bigfoot or the man wolf came out of the UFO.
Right.
It's interesting to speculate about it, but, you know, I do try to keep my reporter hat on as much as I can and try not to make leaps that are too big. And believe me, just saying that I research werewolves sounds like a big enough leap to most people as it is.
Certainly, yeah. Well, it would be nice if you could take the werewolf out of the paranormal field and into, you know, the zoological field, the normal mainstream. 'Cause
it would.
Right? It's a true creature.
It would. I don't know if it'll happen. I really would love for somebody to get good video footage of one of these creatures locomoting on its hind legs, making those movements. And it's so interesting because witness after witness after witness, people who've never heard of each other, people who've never read any of the other reports, anyone who gets a good look at this creature describes its movement in the same way. And usually they'll even come up with almost the same words because there's no other way to really describe it. But they'll say, first of all, that while it was running or walking rather easily, it still appeared that the legs were bent backwards. And that's what I'll get from people all the time. The legs were bent backwards. That's because a canine walks on its toe pads, and its heels are up above the ground where we're sort of expecting to see something like a knee bending forwards. But instead, we're seeing that heel and ankle joint, and it looks to us like it's bending the wrong way. Whereas it would be like, you know, us walking on our tiptoes and then seeing that heel sticking out there. And then they'll also say, and the other thing is that it was sort of hunched over or bent a little at the neck. I'll hear that all the time. And that makes great sense also if you're thinking about canine anatomy, because their neck and head are not set onto their body the same way ours is. Their neck and head are set on so that they can look up and look straight ahead while they're walking on all fours. Whereas if you think about it, if you as a human get down on your hands and knees to crawl, unless you make a real effort to look up, your nose is going to be pointed at the floor.
Right, right.
You know, so we have a very different makeup to our skeleton because we're designed to be bipeds. These creatures, from all evidence, are still in their quadruped design, but they've been able to adapt enough. They may have a slightly different hip structure. Perhaps that's one of the areas that's still adapting, and it would be interesting to find one that you could positively identify as having been one of these bipedally walking canines and then be able to do a post-mortem on it and see if there were variations in the skeleton, see if the toe pads are elongated, see if there is some kind of hip adaptation or shoulder adaptation. That's the other area, because people will sometimes say, well, it did seem to have shoulders, and canines don't have shoulders. They really don't.
Huh.
You know, if you think about a dog, if a dog is sitting on its haunches, you can see shoulders. There are legs that go from the neck. There's the neck, and then there's the legs going downwards in one straight, smooth motion. Whereas if a human is sitting kind of on its haunches, you know, if you're trying to squat on your toes and you're right down there, even if you put your hands on the floor in between your legs, trying to imitate a dog, you're still going to have those shoulders sticking out.
Right.
And the dog does not.
Well, it's interesting stuff. Well, the people who see these things are very lucky to have you out there, because I don't think there's really a lot of other people to turn to who are, you know, have the database that you do and have talked to so many people.
No, I think that's true. I really, as far as I know, have the very largest contemporary collection of sightings of this creature.
Wow.
To find anything else, you have to go back centuries to the writings of, like, Montague Summers or some of the early documents. And you can find large, large field studies of Bigfoot and other things, but to find contemporary accounts, a large body of them, that of this creature that looks like an upright werewolf, I really don't know of anybody who's gotten quite as many. Nick Redfern has done a lot of work in Great Britain and is starting to collect more in the United States too. But he's sort of doing the same thing in Great Britain, but he tends to come down really even more than I do on the side of the idea that the best logic, really the best explanation, it doesn't sound logical, but if you're trying to fit the facts, is that idea of the transdimensional window area, because it's just so hard to explain
right.
how there could be so many of them within certain small areas.
Well, you know what, Linda? I'm going to have to stop the show. Our time is pretty much up. I want to give you a chance, though, to give out any websites that you might have where people could get some more information about you and your books.
Sure, that went really fast. Yeah, you can go to www.beastofbrayroad.com. And I also I just started updating my radio schedule on there, so you'll find some other links of other shows I'm going to be on. I have a book page, and there's a blog that you can go to. You can report sightings from it. And there are some sightings logs that I don't always keep quite up to date anymore, but there's a lot of interesting stuff on there, including that photo that I talked about earlier. I also have weirdmichigan.com, and you can find me on MySpace, too. I keep kind of a running blog there as well.
Cool. Well, I'd love to have you back on the show so you can kind of give us, because we barely scratched the surface. I kind of was hoping we would take a tour through Weird Wisconsin and Weird Michigan.
That would be so fun. Yeah, we'll get you some copies of those books, and I think you'll be amazed at all the strange creatures in those, and UFOs. And we're more onto your topic as well.
Awesome. Yeah, well, cool. We'll maybe back in a couple of weeks or so. All right.
That would be wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. It's awesome. All right, everyone, that is our show for tonight. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. You've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and tonight our guest has been Linda Godfrey. She's written many books, more than 10, including The Beast of Bray Road, Hunting the American Werewolf, two in a series of called Mysteries, Legends, and Unexplained Phenomena, Strange Wisconsin, Strange Michigan, Weird Wisconsin, Weird Michigan. It goes on. Check them out. I think you'll be amazed. Until then, I want to thank you again for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful night and a great week. Bye now.